All right, just a quick announcement. This one's on the personal side. If you don't already know, I got a call Thursday, and one of my friends of 40 years died. So he'd been having some heart trouble, AFib, for some time. But had just had a heart ablation Monday, and I had talked to him after that. He was on his way home. He sounded fine and was upbeat and everything. And so then I called him Wednesday. I wasn't feeling great last Tuesday, and so I called him Wednesday and just got a message. He wasn't taking calls that I don't remember quite. It was something I'd never heard before. It wasn't his voicemail. But my guess was he just turned his phone off so people wouldn't bother him and laid down, and hopefully that was it. Who knows? But at any rate, pray for me. I haven't decided. I haven't heard anything yet as to what the plans are. But I may want to go if there's a funeral. But I have logistical issues getting there, so that may or may not be a good idea. So just pray I'll make the right decisions. And I love my friend Tom, but I'm not overly emotional about it. I'm not freaking out. I got to go do something, you know. So, but I'd like to do the right thing, and it may or may not be going there. So that's just a personal request. All right, let's make sure you're in fellowship, and let's continue on here dealing with this matter, a part of Category 2 love, which begins first with the idea of the husband and wife, the marriage. That's the primary aspect of it, but certainly secondary to that is the matter of family. And that's what divine institution number two encompasses. Divine institution number one is volition, of course. Divine institution number two, family. God provided everybody free will. Divine institution one, number two, this includes all of that. Number three is nationalism. That is God's plan. Nationalism is God's plan, or that's divine institution number four. But I have to go back and review those. But at any rate, internationalism isn't God's plan. But the first two are obviously key to this, and that's the ones we want to focus on. Because everybody's got volitional freedom. And then out of that volitional freedom comes choices for two people to voluntarily enter into a marriage vow. And then from there, obviously, the normal outflow of that is a family. It's children. That's not true in every case. We understand there are exceptions to the rule, but the fact is this is probably 90% of families have children. And we're dealing with this matter now of obedience. Children are expected to be. They're not always going to be because they got sin natures. But of course, then the parents have to put aside their natural affection for them. That would be the storge type affection, again, not used in the scripture, and do what's in the child's best interest. And as we were talking on break, I pointed out that really, by the time they're age two, you really should have already started dealing with your child. They don't call them the terrible twos for nothing. And that means you didn't do right in the ones during that year. The child had put things over on the parents because parents sometimes aren't that smart. And a child that wants to run the show can be pretty smart and pretty sneaky and pretty conniving. That's just the nature of children. They don't know any better. It's not like they're totally malicious, I don't think. But they don't know. Well, consistent verbal instruction. That's the first thing. First, you're talking to your children. The idea of parenting, you're responsible for teaching them doctrine. And what are the parameters of behavior? And what's expected? And all of that. And to lay out, as a parent, you have to have boundaries. And you have to establish these things. And so the children knows how the household runs. What's expected? Everybody has a part in this. So consistent verbal instruction. First, you cannot overteach them, I don't think. You want to make sure they know what's expected, what the responsibilities and requirements are. And coupled with physical discipline as needed. And that's not always needed. Generally speaking, I remember when the kids were young, you would begin to feel this tension within the household as they were starting to push the boundaries. They would see what they could get away with. And then when they got caught, eventually something major enough, sometimes they wouldn't do anything bad enough to get a spanking and kind of clear the air. And so you just kind of had to wait as a parent. and discipline them when the situation came up. And of course, there's a way to discipline them and all that. You don't discipline them out of anger. You don't slap them. You don't scream at them. You don't beat them. None of those things are appropriate. We're absolutely against child abuse of any kind. And but see, normal human emotion doesn't even exist out there anymore. Normal family emotion hardly exists. Parents killing their kids, tossing them off, dumping them off, abandoning them, you know, that's not normal. So this is the standard that is espoused by the Word of God. Deuteronomy 6:6-7. And it all starts with the teaching, just as the Christian life here all starts with the teaching in Bible class. That's not the end of it, but that's certainly where it starts. And it's designed to go through to application. Deuteronomy 6:6. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. First, number one, all the parents are supposed to pay attention to these things and take care of these and make sure they are squared away on the truth as well. And you shall teach them diligently to your sons. And you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. As a good parent, you're looking for opportunities to reinforce the principles of the truth within the life of the child. And that can be anywhere and everywhere. Everything can be a teaching opportunity. But the reality is that doctrinal instruction is the responsibility of the parents. Now, when we've had children here, we will make arrangements to have a prep school where they can get doctrine broken down to their age, proper age, and their intellectual understanding and all of that. But that goal of all of that, of course, is just to prepare them to sit in Bible class to learn like the adults are learning. But your job as parents, if you have children in the house, it's to teach them. It's to make sure they know what the responsibilities are, what the requirements are, and they can live a happy life. You shall teach them diligently to your son, in the house, walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. You make this a part of your life. The Christian life is exactly that. It's a lifestyle. And the biblical lifestyle is that we raise up our children in the realm of doctrine. Now, there's no guarantees with kids. We all know that. I know that when we had our kids, Michael, the older one, he was always in something. Just too much like me when I was young, I guess. Always in something. And sometimes that God would do that. God would drive that little lesson home to me. I remember one night, I think he was supposed to be home at 10 or 11. I don't remember what it was. It got to be 12, yeah. 1, and he's not home. I'm laying there thinking, oh my God, what's he done? You know. And then when I was laying there waiting on him to come in, and I went and laid down in the front room with the lights out in the shadow where he couldn't see me. And when he came in, he was in the kitchen getting something to drink or doing whatever he was doing. I say, how's it going? And you should have seen him jump. Where have you been? And I'd actually gone out because I knew there was only a few places he probably could be. And I went to those places, which weren't really far from our house. And but as I was laying there on the sofa, I believe it was God, the Holy Spirit, said, remember your mom doing this for you? Laying awake at night, wondering where you are. So I come home one morning, the next morning, I'm asking her for my car title. She goes, you were in jail last night, weren't you? I said, no, what makes you think that? Of course I was. you know, so the parents do have some instincts. That is a fact. I've seen that even in my parents. They said they were believers. I hope they are, they're both dead now, but hope they're both believers. But my mom would time to time know when I was in trouble, and that was pretty evident. And so as I laid there thinking about that, I thought, this is discipline, isn't it? I'm going to get to go through the same thing. But that's what all parents want. That's what you tell your kids when they're growing up. I hope you have one just like you. So Michael was always into something. Well, Laura was smart. She's a couple, 3 years younger, 3 or 4 years younger, I guess. And she was a little smarter. And I asked her one time, well, why, you know, how is it you don't get into as much trouble. Well, I just watch Michael, and I do the opposite. So you have a negative example that often turns out to be a positive example in some sense, because she didn't give us, and of course that was not her nature anyway. Girls typically don't tend to be as difficult as boys. Boys are more rambunctious. They got more testosterone, what little they have at that age anyway. And so boys are a little bit more troublesome, but you teach them. You teach them early. Again, you can't start too early with this stuff. You say, well, I don't think they're getting all of it. They don't have to get all of it. Did you get everything the first time through when people taught you? No. And, don't worry about them getting all of it. Just be diligent and disciplined about it. Also, Proverbs 29:15. The rod and reproof give wisdom. Now, it's interesting here, too. While people may want to focus on the physical aspect, the rod, they kind of tend to skip over this word reproof. Reproof is just simply telling someone that they're wrong. That's it. You're out of line, you're wrong on this, and you let them know. The rod, obviously, is a figure for physical discipline, for corporal punishment. But a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. And obviously when your children grow up, you want to be proud of them. I mean, you want them to make it spiritually first and foremost. We are trying to raise, as it were, most of us are done now, but trying to raise the next generation of Christians, preparing adjusted believers who know doctrine and can live out the Christian life and be a witness and a standard in this world like we have tried to do. And hold to the truth, which every day is being eroded, being attacked on every front. That's just the nature of the world right now. And it's getting worse, and we know it's getting worse. So you want your kids, as much as you can, to make you proud when they're older. Well, the way to do that's discipline when they're younger. That's how that works. But the reproof part, you've got to correct them verbally, too. It's not just a matter of waiting until you're angry and spanking. And secondly, you never spank them when you're angry. You do not discipline children in anger. That sends all the wrong message. Discipline is supposed to be an exhibition of your love for the child, not you taking out your vengeance because you're upset. That's inappropriate. Also, Ephesians 6:4. One that we saw not too terribly long ago. Now this one's geared at the father. This aspects of parenting that the parents need to consider. And just because it's addressed to the fathers, and it would be because of the nature of society, the paterfamilias, as we know, was the issue there that day in Rome. And so, but this doesn't mean mothers can't do it too. I've watched parents try to live their lives vicariously through their children. That's a huge mistake. That is a huge mistake. I've seen parents, sometimes mothers, sometimes fathers. I mean, when we were growing up, all our dads wanted us to be baseball players. But that was okay because that's all we wanted to be. We weren't being shoved into something we hated. I loved baseball. My idea of heaven was playing baseball forever. Now, of course, I was only 9 or 10. I wasn't very old, but still. Or 12. I think I played Little League through about junior high. No, I didn't even play through junior high. It was probably maybe 7th grade I did. It was the last year. But we were moving around so much that, you know, you get on a team and 2 years later you'd be somewhere else. So fathers, do not provoke your children to anger with unreasonable or excessive demands that the child is not capable maybe fully of fulfilling. One, you have to, when dealing with children, you have to consider their age, their abilities, their qualities, kind of their makeup. Boys, with our son anyway, it was almost always going to take a spanking or some form of discipline to get through to you. The girl, you could look at her mean, and she could burst into tears if she knew something bad was coming. And so, girls were more sensitive. So we don't want to, as parents, we want to do those things that are appropriate to their age, to their station. And we're trying to bring them along. And that means teaching them things. And that means you can't be frustrated because they don't get it right away. There should be one in here, children, don't provoke your parents to anger. And if it hadn't have been so funny, I probably would have been angry, but I came home one day, and Michael told me, this was when he was younger, I guess he must have been maybe 12 or 13, well, maybe not even that old, must have been younger than that, but he goes, well, I cleaned the lawnmower for you. I said, what do you mean you cleaned the lawnmower? Well, I washed out the gas tank and... Okay. But it struck me as so funny when I got home that I wasn't mad about it. I thought, oh my. Well, but see, that was a kid. He had the heart in the right place. You got to appreciate that. He wanted to help. And, you know. But when you tell him to wash the car and you see him with a Brillo pad on the finish, you know, uh-oh. So you've got, number one, you've got to prepare them and tell them what's what. And you've got to show them. You've got to teach children. And this isn't necessarily fun stuff in parenting, but it's stuff that has to be done. Because, again, we're trying to raise believers who will carry on the doctrinal traditions, the apostolic doctrinal traditions that we study. And that we want to carry on. So don't provoke them to anger. Give them things within reason. But you should be trying to bring them along. You should be challenging them a little bit as they grow. You don't want to make things too easy on them. Certainly you don't want to hand them everything. We've got a whole generation now that came up believing at 16 they were entitled to a cell phone, a car, a free college, everything they wanted, essentially. Well, one, parents do not have those obligations. And a lot of this give the kids whatever they want has turned us out a generation of people who don't know how to function. They don't know how to go without. They don't know how to suffer. They don't know how to struggle. They think everything should be handed to them. And that's just not real life. My dad taught me early on, there's no such thing as a free lunch. And so when I got old enough, I wanted to get a car. Well, he said, okay, I got your answer for you. Really? Yep, get a job. I said, oh, okay, well, I got to get a job to pay for the car, you know, but I'm going to need gas and insurance. He says, that's right. And I'm not getting it. You're going to get it if you get the car. And I remember I was so proud of a 64 Chevy Impala. And I think I paid, what did I pay for that car? I think it was $250. maybe it was $300. I don't remember. But anyway, I remember having to pay payments. I had 6 months of payments of like whatever it was, $35 a month or something. Maybe it was a year at $35. Maybe it was $350 I paid for it. But at any rate, then I had to have insurance, and I had to say, well, you better call them and see what, you know, you'll have to be put on mine, but you're paying the difference. And, of course, I didn't really like insuring 16-year-old boys with a brand-new driver's license. But I got that, and then, of course, I had to have gas. And so Dad didn't, you know, hand us stuff. He said, hey, look, this is the real world out here. You're going to have to get along in it, and people aren't going to just be handing you stuff because you think they should. So he never really provoked me to anger. Matter of fact, I really still, well, by the time I got older, I didn't really like him because I didn't agree with his politics and different things. But that's not uncommon, really, in growing up for, you know, kids, the younger generation. I remember hearing this all the time. The younger generation, what passes as music? And, you know, that isn't music. And then I grew up and they, you don't know, you know, Hendrix's music. You don't have any idea. You don't know anything. I don't want to listen to the Sons of the Pioneers. I want to be a hippie. And I don't want your country western, your conservative stuff. And then I get up and I find at 45 or 50, probably later, 50, 60. What passes as music today, this younger generation? There's a song by a guy named Ian Hunter. He says, I am what I hated when I was young. I've become what I hated when I was young. You don't want to be that crotchety old guy that nothing's good enough, nothing fits, nothing's right. Here's how we used to do it. Back in the old days. And then people look at you and say, I wish you were back in the old days. You know. At first when I moved down here to Florida, too, I kind of wondered. I'd see these bumper stickers. I saw them pretty frequently. We don't care how you did it up north. And I realized there was a lot of that going on. People come down here and say, well, we don't do it that way. Go back if you don't like it. So you want to bring your children up. You don't want to provoke them. You're not trying, but you want to push them, but properly. You want them to grow and in that direction, and not just they're walking around angry all the time because they can never please you. This is one of the problems at some level, a generalization again, but men tend to be, again, much more stern, not as easily pleased, not as forthcoming with compliments and all of that. And my dad, you know, I remember, because he was the coach of our little league team too. And so he was not only my dad, but he was the coach. Well, he would not play favorites, so I never got any, which is good. I wasn't raised up thinking, oh, I should get extra deal because my dad's the coach. No, I did. I played wherever they told me to play, and he made the decisions and all of that. And he never really was, you know, but he would offer criticism sometimes, like, you know, I said, well, I thought I was going to beat that hit out. And he goes, yeah, but you run too long in one place. That was his way of telling me I was slow. So, but I do, I remember at one time we had this one game. It went into extra innings, which is rarity in Little League. You know, the scores are often, you know, 28 to 26 or, you know, it wasn't quality pitchers duels or anything at that league at that age. And we had this game and it had gone into extra innings and we'd run out of pitchers and I was the catcher and I'd already caught six innings. And I those of you who've never caught in baseball don't know how hard that position is. It is the catcher's call. First, number one, they call the tools of ignorance. That's the catcher's gear. But it takes it out of you. I mean, you're in a squatting position all the time. You're constantly moving. You got a lot. Well, I'd caught six innings, and they ran out of pitchers, so Dad put me in. Well, I guess apparently I was so tired that the umpire told him in between innings, he goes, you know, this guy's got a natural drop ball. It was probably the ball was getting to the plate and going like that was what was happening. It wasn't a natural drop ball. But I remember we got the final out, and we won the game finally. And I actually scored the winning run, which was weird because that only happened once in my life. But I did. And as we were going off the field, my dad ran on, and he picked me up, and I don't think I ever felt better in my entire life. And I knew he loved me and was proud of me. And he was, again, all in all, overall, a good dad. It was tough when he had to be, but he would show occasionally affection. And even after he gave me the worst spanking I ever got, he came in the room and hugged me. And that kind of stuff sticks with kids, I think. So, the parents here, point E now, must deal with the problem of the child's sin nature consistently and cannot allow themselves to be deterred by the child's tears. That's one of the things I noticed. I'd come in, I'd tell the kids, well, if they were both in trouble, but one of them generally at a time. There was a couple of times they both got in trouble as they took a box of matches and went under a 80-year-old dry wooden house and played with fire. We caught that. God blesses the diligent parent, though, see? God always let us know. And I think diligent authorities in general, not just parents, but husbands. Sometimes wives will try to do things behind their back, and God will let the husband know if he wants to do this right. Same thing with pastors and churches, people in positions of authority. We're not here to run your life or live your Christian life for you. You got to do all that. But the reality is sometimes when things are funny or things are going on that shouldn't be, it'll get back to me. We haven't had any real problems here in a while, but that's just the reality of it. The authority that's trying to do their job right, God's going to bless. God's going to bless that person with what they need to know. And one of the things I would find, you know, when you go in there, I'd tell them, okay, because if I was angry or something, I needed to calm down. I wasn't going to go in and spank them right away. And so I'd go in there and they'd be sitting there, why are you crying? It's going to hurt. Yeah, well, don't let that bother you, parents. Just look at the tears and grin. I'm enjoying this. You know, do not hold back discipline from the child. Verse 13. Although you strike him with the rod, he will not die. You're not going to kill him. But he can sure make it sound like he's dying. And that was the thing, you know, they'd be trying, especially the girls more, that she'd be crying before I even spanked her. And that, I'm sorry, unless you're just an automaton, that gets to you. Nobody likes to see their children cry or be in pain. But you knew that big term, long term, they can't, behaviors like this can't be tolerated. So the parents, are the first line of instruction and defense against the sin nature. Failure to fulfill that responsibility brings shame on the parents and discipline on the child. This is the bad thing, that parents who don't address all this, and I've watched parents, both the fundamentalists and parents I've known on doctrine over the years, we started seminary 40 years ago, so it's been more than 40 years I've been listening to the doctrine. And the reality here is that we have to be the responsibility, and if we don't take care of this stuff, the children suffer. And you don't want that. This is the one every parent should memorize. Stupidity is bound up in the heart of the child. And when I say bound up in it, means it is a part of them. This is a part of their fundamental nature as children. And as unbelievers, you also have to recognize that until they're old enough, till they reach the age of accountability and all, you're dealing with a little unbeliever there. Now, he may eventually be a believer. That would be the goal. That was, I would think, what all normal parents want. But just bear in mind, children have an amazing capacity for stupidity. You know? You don't ever see adults putting pennies in light sockets. Nobody does that. Yeah, there are things kids do. I remember my brother convinced me, he was younger than me, but he convinced me, hey, let's go up there. And we had I don't remember what it was. I think it was a rabbit hutch. So it had some height to it. I can't remember. We were back in Delaware in the boonies. But he said, I think if we hold this towel and jump off, it'll be like a parachute. And we'll just float down. It didn't work. I tried it. Didn't work. Didn't just float down. Hit the ground just as hard as if I hadn't held on to that towel. Didn't really understand much physics at that age. And so, children will do dumb stuff. You watch these guys, see them the other day, 17, 18-year-old kid up there racing 105 miles an hour across the Gandy. Dangerous stuff. Stuff that'll get you killed. You're not going to make many mistakes at 100 and survive it. And the problem is, of course, as we know, it's an angry world out there. But foolishness is bound up. So we want to get that out as much as it's our responsibility as parents to do that. But the rod of discipline will remove it far from him. You can teach a child to not being stupid by disciplining stupidity. That's the way you do it. Also, 29:15, we've seen that one, I think. We just read that one. But 29:15 and also 17. The rod and reproof gives wisdom, but a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. This was one of the things we had to work through as parents. Because I recognized that the kids were scared of me. That was easy enough. But they weren't scared of mom. And generally tend to be kids don't and aren't. Because they know mom's the softer touch. And very often, if they wanted something, I observed this developing in the household, they'd go to mom first. Because mom was more likely to give them their way. But then Linda caught on to all of this and said, hey, no, you need to go ask Ron. What? No. Well, then they'll go. Whatever. And my instinct as a parent, which I failed in this regard, I can say this. My first instinct was to always say no, because usually the ideas were dumb. But they weren't always dumb. So, and I failed on that one, because you shouldn't be always no. But you have to listen to the child. And again, what they can do, what they're capable of handling, and all of that. Their age factors into this greatly. But the children typically won't obey the mom as much as the dad. They're not afraid of her. And I don't know how many times I heard as a kid, and I bet you money you may have heard it if you lived in the same kind of house we did. And I'd be acting up in the middle of the day or something, and all I'd hear was, wait till your dad gets home. I wanted to straighten up right then, amazingly enough, because I didn't want to be in trouble from dad. And it wasn't as though my mom never disciplined me. She did. I remember once she washed my mouth out with soap, and that was gross. But I said some flowery words she didn't like, and she said, well, if you keep doing that, I'm going to wash your mouth out with soap. And then I got smart enough to tell her she wasn't big enough. I'm about 5 or 6 at this point. I'm pretty young, maybe even 4. She was big enough. Turned out she was. I was way wrong. And who was the guy in the movie The Christmas Story? I developed a taste. I like Lifebuoy especially. Because he was always getting his mouth washed out. And people see that today. That's child abuse. Put him in jail. Didn't hurt me. Didn't kill me. I did clean up my language a little bit. Which was what it was designed to do. And then verse 17, correct your son. And he will give you comfort. He will also delight your soul. And as we've talked about before, the book of Proverbs is the general book of wisdom, specifically from Solomon, of course, or largely. There are some in here that are not his words. But this is wisdom, and this is the way, if you look at Proverbs, I would call this the book of the way things normally work. The way things God has set them up to work. And then Ecclesiastes, I would call it the book of exceptions. Because there's always exceptions. There's things that don't work the way they're supposed to, and things that don't work out the way they're supposed to, and all of that. But as a parent, when you get older, you want to be comforted by your children. You don't want to look at them with regret. And if you do your job right, again, no matter how the child turns out, you've done your part right. You were a diligent Christian parent. You emphasized doctrine in the household. You provided discipline when necessary. Coupled with all the proper instruction and all that, and the kid turns out to be a spiritual washout. There's nothing you can do about that. That's a frustration as a parent, but you would also know, I've got a clean conscience. I did right by this kid. This kid was blessed. This kid had a fine life, but they're not interested in God and His plan. But that's their deal. That's their volition, and we have to allow for that. Proverbs makes it sound like if you raise a child upright, he'll never depart from the truth. Is that true 100% of the time on every occasion? Nope. Certainly not. So parents that will not, point G, effectively follow through in this area, demonstrate that they do not actually love their child, protest to the contrary notwithstanding. And I've heard adults say stuff like this: I love my child too much to spank him. No, you don't love him enough to spank him. That's the problem. That their rationale that they've accepted is wrong to start with. We've seen this one. He who withholds his rod hates his son. And the language of love and hate is used here because these are extremes. And ideally, obviously, you expect parents to love their children. That means corporal discipline when necessary. And also 19:18. Discipline your son while there's hope. And the hope runs out. Hope declines exponentially as age increases. The longer you go without discipline in them, and the longer you don't deal with stuff, the less hope you have of them going to be turning out okay. Now, there's always exceptions to everything. You got children that were born into poverty. They squalor, didn't have any norms. Their parents had no norms and standards. Maybe they didn't have a dad in the home, didn't have a mom in the home, whatever it was. All kinds of horrible things. And they grow up and they pull themselves up by their bootstraps and they get on through life and they succeed. They make success out of themselves. And so people can do that. But when you've got an environment where you've got children and they're your responsibility, you better discipline them early. And again, while there's hope of change. Because if they don't change certain things, they'll grow up to be bad adults. And do not desire his death. There are times you will want to kill him, however. That may even happen in your marriage. You may sometimes think, "Boy, I wish they were dead." And that's a bad day when you're thinking like that. But it does happen. And, I guess you'll be happy when I'm gone. I darn sure will. You know? Now, I think that was off of young Sheldon. You'll miss me when I'm gone. Oh, I'm not so sure. But again, don't desire his death. You want what's best for him. You know, I understand if you got two people with volition, especially like in a marriage, you're going to want to kill each other sometimes. That's normal. I like it when people say, we never fight, we never disagree. One of you doesn't have a brain, or maybe both of you, I'm not sure which, but one of you doesn't. So you're going to have fights. But again, raising children, marriage, all of this stuff, it's not so much the failing. It's learning how to handle the failures and get ahead progressively in a good sense with it, rather than just making the same stupid mistakes over and over again. You kind of learn as a, you know, when you're married for some years, you go through life, you kind of learn what your wife's triggers are, and she learns yours too, and what buttons to push. And we know everybody that's ever been married, is you know, got that smart little comment you make that you know is going to set something off. And then when it does, I didn't mean anything. I'm the innocent. No, you smarted off and you started it. So, again, working through these things, it isn't that you're not going to fight, not going to fail with your children. It's being diligent, keeping at it, not giving up just because it gets difficult. And there will be times when it's just flat difficult. Well, normal physical discipline does not include physical abuse. I shouldn't have to even put this point in here, but I did. And it should not include oppressing the child with unrealistic expectations or demands. Colossians 3:21, that may be the not exasperating them. Yeah. Well, and here's the important thing here. Fathers, do not exasperate your children so that they will not lose heart. You can ultimately discourage them. That losing heart is a figure for discouragement. Or even depression. And we recognize, I hear this all the time on the news anymore. There's a constant recognition that the younger generation, and particularly the ones that are engaged in social media all the time, are depressed. They don't have any real relationships in life in many cases. They've got Facebook friends. I hate to break it to you folks, but Facebook friends ain't friends. They're not friends. The biblical definition of a friend, this is not even close. This is some social media deal. And I'm not against Facebook or for it. I don't waste any time on it because I don't gain anything from it. There's nothing on it for me to even mess with. If I need to keep up with somebody's life or have a question, I pick up the phone and call them. I don't go check their Facebook page. All that. So if people use it, it's fine, but it's a tool and it's got to be kept within bounds. I've heard of people going on Facebook for 4, 5, 6 hours playing different games, doing this and that. That is entirely too long to be online at anything. I don't think I even study 6 hours straight, and I'm dealing with the Bible, not with Angry Birds or whatever else they're doing. Farmville or whatever. I don't even know what the stuff is anymore because I got off of it so long ago. Never got on Instagram, never got Twitter. Why do I need any of this stuff? The relationships of the Christian life are about face-to-face interaction with believers in a family. That's what a local church is. A mini representation of the great family of God. A microcosm. So don't exasperate them, because if you give them too many unrealistic demands, they're going to lose heart. They're going to give up. They're going to say, this person can't be pleased. I'm never going to make them happy. And then they won't even try. And that's a part of depression. And you don't want to depress your children. They may depress you often enough. But we don't want to depress them. So what it does entail is verbal instruction that defines the parameters of behavior. Verbal warnings as to the consequences of disobedience. And the appropriate physical discipline when the child chooses disobedience. And verbal warnings that constitute, if you do that again, you're going to get a spanking. Stop that right now. I'm counting to three. No. The child needs to be taught right away. Disobedience brings consequences immediately. I'm not going to count to three or ten. I'm not going to tell you, Bobby, get off of there. Bobby, leave that alone. You know, over and over and over again, you see people do this. I've even seen jokes about it on TV, the people that kind of did that. Get away from there. I'm going to kill you when we get home. But well, discipline them right there. And that's another whole issue that you have to deal with as a parent. Again, most of us don't have to now. Is that a public discipline's maybe not appropriate. I've watched parents just humiliate their kids in public. Now, maybe it needs to be done occasionally. I know one woman, she said, if you're going to embarrass me in public, I'm going to embarrass you back. And so that may be necessary sometimes. So just so the child gets the message. And particularly if they tend to act up only when you're in public. They figured out you can be pushed and that they can get away with it. And so, you know, if you warn them, you're going to discipline. You got one chance to disobey and one chance only. And that's it. And then the discipline's going to come. You're going to get whatever. It may not always be a spanking. Could be a lecture. Could be take something away from them. Nowadays, there's lots of things to take away from them. Because they have every detail on the planet. Which isn't really appropriate either, but that's another day. Point C here now, Category 3 love. Love for personal friends. This aspect of love is best demonstrated by the relationship of David and Jonathan. 1 Samuel 18. David, of course, the son of Jesse, was apparently about the same age as Jonathan, the son of Saul. 1 Samuel 18, 1 through 4. And it came about that when he had finished speaking to Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved David as himself. And Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. And then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him. See, he's the prince. He's got a position. This means something. And gave it to David, along with his armor, including his sword and bow and belt. And David went out wherever Saul sent him. David was a loyal subject of King Saul. Saul at this time is beginning to crack, but he hasn't fully cracked yet. But he goes through these periods of jealousy. And then, of course, he finds out, he gets the very bad news, David's been anointed as king in your place. You've lost the kingship. And again, of course, then he wanted to just kill David. And spent a number of times trying to. But Jonathan was loyal to David. And again, they were probably about the same age. And David was prosperous. But then the more prosperous David was, Saul became angry, verse 8. For the saying has displeased him. Saul has slain his thousands, but David his 10,000s. Hey, you're both successful warriors. Why let it bother you? But Saul was jealous. Saul had some other spiritual problems that were festering in the background. Also, 2 Samuel 1:26. And this is following the death of... And this is a good example here. Of failure to separate. Jonathan should have separated from his father Saul. He was of age, he could have, but he remained loyal to Saul, unfortunately. And because of that, when the end came for Saul, it also came for Jonathan. And Jonathan died along with Saul when he could have, if he had stayed loyal with David, might have avoided all that. But 2 Samuel here, 1:26. And I think this is when David is eulogizing him. This is when David... And David does the funeral for Saul and Jonathan. David's upset. He starts this back in verse 17. He chanted this lament over Saul and Jonathan, his son. And he told them to teach the sons of Judah the song of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. Your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How the mighty have the mighty fallen. Tell it not in Gath, the Philistine territory, or Ashkelon. Or the daughters of the Philistines will rejoice. The daughters of the uncircumcised will exult. And so... Verse 22, from the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back. And the sword of Saul did not return empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and pleasant in their life. And in their death, they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How have the mighty fallen in the midst of battle? Jonathan is slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, O my brother Jonathan. You have been pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. This was the kind of relationship, and of course, modern day theologians want to turn this into a homosexual relationship. That's not what he's saying at all. He is saying that they had this wonderful friendship that transcended. Well, and really, when you consider David, you might want to consider the women he met and dealt with. Let's see. How about Michal? She was a prize. Saul's daughter? Oh, what a catch she was. But they just had a wonderful relationship. This is friendship at its highest level. It's not sexual at all. So a true friend, point two, loves consistently at all times. Now, that's, we all fail at that. Nobody loves consistently at all times, but that's the goal. That's the ideal we shoot for. Maintaining loyalty and allegiance to his friend. Personal failures notwithstanding. How are you going to have friends that don't fail? Well, good luck on that. When you find all these people that don't fail you, let me know. I may need some new ones. But those don't exist, as we know. Everybody's going to fail. Proverbs 17:17. A friend loves at all times. And a brother is born for adversity. And here, this is what we call synonymous parallelism. It advances it a little bit, but the friend and the brother are parallel, same person. And then the all time is replaced with this matter of the difficult times. That they love in adversity. They don't abandon their friend when he's in trouble. Also, 18:24. A man of too many friends comes to ruin. If you want to be popular with everybody, you're going to have to compromise. That's the only way to have that. If you want universal popularity, you've got to make some compromises and changes. But there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. And that's the kind of friendship we're talking about. Most theologians allude this to the Lord, of course, because he never abandons his children at all. So a real friend can be counted on. And to respond in adverse circumstances. This is why it says he's born for adversity or during unexpected times of testing, because that's when you know who your friends are. Who could I count on? What if something bad happened and you have to go to somebody's house at midnight? Who would you go to? Where would you go? Who could you count on? Well, everybody in this local church should be able to count on everyone here. That's what the local body is all about. Luke here, 11, 5 through 8. And then he said to them, suppose one of you has a friend and goes to him at midnight and says to him, friend, lend me 3 loaves. My first question would be, why are you here at midnight to get bread? You know, I might not be happy about it, but you should be. For a friend of mine. Okay, now we get to the reality of it. He was taken by surprise. This was an unexpected incident. A friend of mine has come to me from a journey. Apparently did not notify him, just showed up. And in that day, that would have been more understandable too. Now with cell phones and text and email, and to just show up somewhere. Oh, we do have telephones too still. Telephones, text, email. Well, you should be able to let people know. But he apparently did not, and I have nothing to set before him. Now, he might have himself been put out with this friend who suddenly imposes on him. Who knows how he felt about it? But what he does do is he gets up and he shows hospitality properly. And from inside, he answers and says, do not bother me. The door has already been shut, and my children and I are in bed. I cannot get up and give you anything. And I tell you, even though he will not get up and give him anything because he is his friend, Yet because of his persistence, he will get up and give him as much as he needs. And what is not stated here, but is implicit in this, is that he's not going away. He keeps knocking. Because that's in the immediate context of the teaching. And he goes ahead and makes that plain in verse 9. So I say to you, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you. And so this guy's going to stay out there and keep banging on the door till he gets his bread. That's the way it's going to be. And you've got to be pretty good friends to do that. You better be. Of course, nowadays they may shoot you through the door. You don't want that. But again, we wouldn't have to show up on anybody's doorstep. This is not the same kind of culture. But I do know, like, if somebody calls me late at night, I don't have a phone in my bedroom. My cell phone's never in there. That I won't hear it after I go to bed. That's just the reality. I'll see it at night. I got a call or a text or something, but I never see him probably till 8 the next morning if I get up and go check my cell phone. So again, that's a good friend that you could count on. You could show up at midnight. A real friend can be counted on there to respond in an adverse situation. A true friend does not slander or malign. On the other hand, he can be counted to tell his friend what he needs to hear, even when it is painful. So we want to avoid, and of course this is in a general sense true outside of friendship, Psalm 15:3. But in a general sense, we don't really want to, Paul says speak evil of no man. Don't slander anybody. We don't want to speak evil of people. If you can talk about a person in an even-handed fashion and you got no axe to grind and there's no passion or emotion in it, that's one thing. That's discussing a situation. But if you've got a hidden agenda, if you're angry, if other factors come into play, then no, that can easily get into slander and maligning. And you don't want to do that. So who is it that God looks for? Who may abide in your tent? In other words, whom will the Lord have fellowship with? Who will dwell on your holy hill? He who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. He does not slander with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend. Somebody may have some issue. I've had situations arise where I had one person tell me one of my friends had done something, and the way they painted the picture, it looked like this friend was really an idiot. That it was way out of line. And then when I contacted that friend and said, hey, what about what happened here and here and here? And I got the other side of the story. I found, I was given a line of goods here. I was sold a bill of goods. Because nothing happened the way it was explained to me. And this is one of the things even in life, obviously not just in regard to friendship, but in a general sense. Be careful about what you listen to and who's telling you what, and how much of it is actually true. And on point. Because people can oftentimes tell stories in such a way as to make themselves look good and the other person look bad. And all of us have probably done that. I can't remember any time I've done it, but I probably have. People tell things in a certain way, so it reflected well on them and badly on the other person. Well, one, obviously, anytime you get a situation like this, a report about a friend or something, get to the bottom of it. Don't just react to it. Find out what's going on before you make any judgment decisions, any value decisions on it. You forget the facts. That's an important thing in everything. This is why when people, if they go through these divorces, people side up and then they start picking sides and they don't always have all the facts and rumors and innuendo get spread. And that's just not healthy, and it doesn't solve anything. Also here, Proverb 27, 6 and 9. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. And literally, I believe in the Hebrew, I'd have to go back and check, but I believe this is faithful are the bruises of a friend. And this isn't that you're out fighting each other and beating each other up. These are spiritual or emotional bruises that come as a result of your friend having to tell you stuff you don't want to hear. But deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. So 6 there and 9, oil and perfume make a heart glad. So a man's advice is sweet to his friend. This is a good thing about having good friends. Good doctrinal friends that are solid and you know you can count on their opinion. You know they're not going to give you a bunch of human viewpoint. They may not tell you what you want to hear. And that's when we have to be careful. If we go to somebody, I'd like advice or prayer on this or that. And they may tell you what you need to do and you may not want to hear it. There's that. But ultimately, good advice is good advice. And we should be very appreciative of that. And having people that you can count on, you can trust. Hey, I've got a question here. Doctrinally, I don't know. We have, a chain of command. We encourage you to check with other believers if you don't know something. Or a deacon, you can ask me. I'd prefer you not come to me first. But I'm not against answering questions. It's not that. Remember when I first started doctrine, of course, and to some extent, even when I was first a believer, I wanted to grow so badly and I wanted to know so much that you just felt like you weren't getting it all. And so I would go to other people and ask, hey, what about this? What about this? What about this? Well, you have to recognize that, one, God brings us along at his point in time, too. He's got a plan behind all this. And you don't get all the truth all at once. And so it is good to have people to bounce things off of. People that you can count on that come up with sound teaching and not human viewpoint. So, all right, well, our time's gone there today. We're going to have to stop there. We will continue on here on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.